From the Sky News Centre at 5, a light aircraft and helicopter have crashed mid-air over Buckinghamshire. Emergency services say there have been a number of casualties. Wreckage is scattered among crews at Wadston near Aylesbury. The plane's believed to hold one pilot and one passenger. Both aircraft came from nearby Wickham Air Park, which trains pilots. A jury's taken just half an hour to find a taxi driver guilty of murdering his two children. Endris Mohammed also tried to kill his wife. Kate Holdsworth reports.
The 47-year-old Uber driver killed his 8-year-old son and 6-year-old daughter with a petrol-soaked cloth before setting the family home alight in Hampstead in October last year. Detective Inspector Justin Spanner says it's a tragic case.
The mum of the children has lost absolutely everything in this. She's lost her children, she's lost her husband, she's lost her house, she's lost her career.
Jackie Hughes was staying opposite the house on Holland Road that night and tried to help.
I went in shot myself after trying CPR and that's all I could do. It's all horrible nightmare.
Endris Mohammed is due to be sentenced on Monday.
EU leaders say much more progress is needed for Brexit negotiations to move to the next stage by the beginning of next month. Theresa May's been holding talks in Sweden. Robert Mugabe's been speaking publicly for the first time since Zimbabwe's military took control of the country. He's been handing out degree certificates but didn't speak about the fact he's been under house arrest since Wednesday.
I hereby confer certificates, diplomas and degrees of the Zimbabwe Open University.
Mr. Mugabe's asked for a few more days or months as the country's president as he faces calls to resign over claims of corruption. A woman's been appointed to the House of Lords Blackrod for the first time in the role's 650-year history. Sarah Clark will take over in the new year. And in cricket, Australia's women have retained the Ashes after beating England in a T20 in Sydney. That's the latest. I'm Kate Gibson.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is NHS Finance Manager and Labour Party member Esther Giles. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, fighting within ZANU PF for succession. Is it a coup or not a coup? Also, the UN is saying the Yemen blockade must end or thousands will die. And Save the Children says 130 children are dying every day now in Yemen. So when are we going to stop giving arms, bombs and planes and RAF personnel to help the Saudis do it? And in Turkey, the Kurdish YPG, Peshmerga, aims to conquer the Syria region. Is it going to succeed? And there are reports that the Saudi king is going to step down and crown his 32-year-old son, who's been doing all these purges recently, as the new king. And Russia is naming the 9 US-funded media that are likely to face legal restrictions in Moscow as a reply to the Americans clamping down on the embassies in the US and particularly on Russia Today, the Russian TV channel. And are we getting ready for an epic world war, starting with Iran, perhaps? Well, it's Freemason and Confederate General Albert Pike's letter from 1875. We'll have another listen, the second part of that. The final part, also tonight. Plus, of course, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius, mainly dry. This weekend, around 10 Celsius, a cloudy weekend with a bit of drizzle tomorrow, but better, shouldn't be raining on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, sunshine and showers, windy at times. Next weekend, 25th and 26th of November, highs again around 11 and sunny spells and showers next weekend. That was the Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, over the last few weeks, we've been talking taking a look at the way at cocaine and gangsters in St Paul's were used to take the fight out of Afro-Caribbean community during Thatcher's 1980s. In 1984, while a quarter of a million British miners were being reduced down to 50,000, so that's 200,000 miners getting the sack, in 1985, the travellers at Stonehenge at the Battle of the Beanfield, they were being attacked by the police. And in 1986, print workers at Wapping were part of Rupert Murdoch's spearhead to halve the number of print workers in Britain from around about 80,000 at the beginning of the 1980s to half that by the end of the decade. In Bristol, the St Paul's riots on the 2nd of April 1980 were the first in a series of riots across the country, most notably in Liverpool's Toxteth and Brixton in South East London. This week I managed to track down a football coach and TV sports personality in Ghana who was a colourful community leader here in Bristol throughout the early 1980s and led Bristol West Labour Party, also St Paul's Community Association, both in the resistance to Thatcherism and against the Conservative support for apartheid South Africa in the 1980s. He's just been describing to me how his work and community resolve in the city was disrupted, first in 1985 by the introduction, mostly through nightclubs, of large amounts of cheap cocaine into St Paul's, and then brought to an abrupt end in around 1986 by what he alleges was first a threat with a gun and shortly afterwards attempted murder with a machete. He said a gangster called Valentine Walker, who ran the Crystal Dove nightclub on the front line, wanted him dead and out of town. Balagoon, as he was known at the time, was hospitalised with a nasty machete gash in the neck, and Valentine was charged, and the allegations came to court, but evidence presented that Balagoon had fabricated the attack on himself because he wanted to frame Valentine. He believed he was a police informer. After several hearings, Valentine was found not guilty, and after a discussion with Bristol West Labour Party, Balagoon decided to leave the city in fear of his life. I wouldn't be surprised if Marvin Rees is listening tonight, because Balagoon tells me he contacted a woman called Jen Dye about the interview he'd done for this show, and she went straight to Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, protesting that it shouldn't be broadcast because it is, and I quote, racist mudslinging. And this is known, apparently, as a racist mudslinging programme, at least according to Jen Dye, that is. Anyway, tonight I cannot let you hear Balagoon's shocking and graphic account of the attack on him at his office in St Paul's Community Development Agency, which was the subject of the court case, simply because it wouldn't be fair, not having been able to contact Valentine to put his side of events. If anyone can help me do that, please contact me via BCFM or on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. Though he still alleges Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees's father, Valentine, tried to kill him with a machete, he has no hard feelings towards the family and sends Valentine's son, Marvin, all the very best wishes in his attempts to run the city. Well, he's now known as Nana Kwaku Angamang. Back then it was Ras Kuumba Balagoon, and he has a fascinating story to tell, which we're going to hear a bit of now. But Esther, I wonder what you make of this history, I suppose, fitting in to what was a very tumultuous decade, the 1980s here in Bristol, and what with Bristol's riots in St Paul's leading to riots in other parts of the country.
Yes, I remember it. I was a student at the time, back in Bristol for the Easter holidays, and I can remember the riot starting and the bemusement at first as to what had started it, why it was going on, and then seeing it spreading across Britain, for me, I think I was 20, was astonishing.
Before we hear from Martin on this, let's have a listen now to Balagoon, as he was known at the time, Nana, now.
I'm Nana Kweku Adjiman, I was formerly known as Ras Kuumba Jahidi Balagoon. I lived in Bristol as an infant. I went to the Newfoundland Road Infant School, or Junior School at the time, when I was around 18. We had the 2nd of April disturbances, 1980, where the police came down onto Grosvenor Road quite heavy-handedly, and tried to rough up some of the people there. I was on a Manpower Services Commission course at the time in Easton, and I heard about what had happened, and there were quite a few of us over there, and so we marched quickly over to St. Paul's, and the rest is history. That gave birth to the disturbances in 1980, and then after that, everything else let loose. Brixton, Toxteth, Handsworth, Moss Side, you know, everything else happened after that. Well, in the riots, they came to arrest someone. What I was told was, because I was in Easter, they came to arrest someone, a little scuffle occurred. They tore the guy's trouser, and he said they would have to pay for it. And, of course, the police weren't having any of that. A scuffle entailed, it kind of dissipated, but it was clear that the police would have to take action. And swiftly the word got around to the adjoining areas of St. Paul's that there was a problem in St. Paul's. And of course, St. Paul's was a place that we all congregated. It was like a safe haven. I mean, the system called it a no-go area, but that wasn't specifically true. It's just that on the Grosvenor Road, you had the Black and White Cafe, and you had various other little shops and entities there where young guys gathered. I mean, the girls didn't really gather around there. It was really the guys. And of course, during those times, the opportunities to get employment and tertiary education and that kind of thing was quite limited. So that was the only place that we could really congregate. So when that became under threat, we all zoomed in from the various areas where we were. And as I said, I was doing a Manpower Services Commission course at the time. And I left that course halfway through. I think I was doing carpentry at the time, with a group of other lads, and we all headed to St. Paul's. When we got there, we could see there were some minor skirmishes and everything and what have you. We didn't waste any time. We got involved because we were defending our community. We were defending ourselves against the system, against institutions that didn't want us to participate, that didn't want to see our development. And so we had to stand up there and fight for our rights, which is what we did.
Well, the police would say that what they were doing was coming to implement the law in an area which was lawless.
Well, that's not true. I mean, the area was not lawless. And if it was lawless, the police contributed to that lawlessness. It wasn't lawless at all. At the end of the day, they wanted to arrest people. They felt that they could arrest people in any which way they chose. And we were letting them know that wasn't possible. We're not in Mississippi, you know, or Charleston, or, you know, or Texas. Everything must be done in due course, with a due process, and must be applied appropriately. And it wasn't being applied appropriately, and so we had to resist that, had to stand up for our rights and defend ourselves.
Well, during that period, I actually lived in Brixton, and what happened in Brixton was what was called Operation Swamp. And I remember hundreds of plainclothes police officers arrived in Brixton and started searching everybody as they were, you know, basically drug searches for anybody who was under the age of 25. You were the target, black or white.
Stop and search.
Stop
and,
yeah, but they weren't even in uniform. I mean, I remember, and it had been building up for several weeks, because I remember coming back from the pub with some friends of mine, and these lads pulled up in a Ford Cortina, and they leaped out of the car, and we thought, we're in a fight here, because they were just lads. And then they said, police officers, up against the wall, and they were 19-year-old police officers, dressed like casuals, and they were police officers, and they were just harassing and hassling everybody. And what happened on the morning, they arrived on the Friday evening, and I came back on the train in Brixton, and I could see what was happening, is gangs of black youth were basically behind the it was like corrugated iron fencing. There was lines of lads just passing rocks in a line to create, you know, piles of stones. Petrol bombs were being prepared, and the police were, hundreds of police were walking up and down. So they provoked it, and then of course at a certain point it kicked off. And at that point the police didn't have the kind of riot gear they've got now. They were taken by surprise. They got their asses pretty soundly kicked, and then and the whole place went up. And the first riot was...
Well, the police will say one of the reasons they're going around in plain clothes is because these are so-called no-go areas that the police in uniform might actually be assaulted.
Well, I mean, the Scarman inquiry in Bristol, in Brixton, finally concluded that the police were responsible for provoking the riot, because they were. I mean, lots and lots of incidents happened in the run-up to that riot. But things that happened to me and to my friends and to lots of the people I knew, what it was to do with was the change of government. You'd got a new Conservative government which had decided we're going to show these people who's the daddy.
What they're saying is that they're there to implement the law.
Well, that's the attitude. The attitude was racist. It really was. There was no doubt about it. These were mostly white young men who were police officers, but they had basically racist attitudes. The language they used and all the rest of it, their attitude. And actually, their attitude changed afterwards, because they suddenly realised how dangerous it was to use that kind of language when they were wandering around the streets of Brixton.
Well, let's go back now to Nana, who used to be known as Balagoon here in Bristol. I spoke to him earlier this week from Ghana, and he talks here about fighting the police.
We were fighting against the institution. We were fighting against the system. And this society was a society that would rather see young black guys in prison or mental institutions than anywhere else. And they went out of their way to ensure that young black guys were criminalized in a systematic way. So when they talk about, you know, cannabis and the likes, when they had their opportunities, they would come in, they would arrest you, they'd bring you down to Trinity Road Police Station, they'd try to pin any little charge they possibly could on you, because that's how they could pin a label on you, because you would become a convict, you'd become a criminal, and they would know where you are. It would be easy to monitor you, and you wouldn't be clean anymore. It would make it difficult for you to progress in life. And that's what that system was about. That's what it did.
And when Balagoon was up in Nottingham in the early part of the 1980s, he was involved in a firebombing of a police station. And here he tells that tale, because he did have got a 5-year sentence for it.
Well, I didn't serve 5 years. I think I served 2/3. What happened was I went up there to visit my mum. And I was out with some of the guys, obviously, because I'd finished my secondary education up there. I had quite a few friends up there. I'd gone up there with one of my friends from Bristol. And we were just going to be there for the weekend. We went out on the Friday night in Hyson Green, which is an area similar to St. Paul's. You know, densely populated with African Caribbeans and the like. And we were out there when we saw an older man lying down on the road, and he had blood all over him. And we kind of picked him up. He told us he'd been attacked by a white gang of youths and what have you. And so we carried him to the police station. I mean, in those days, mobile phones and that kind of stuff hadn't got to us yet. We got to the police station, brought him in there, reported that a gang of white youths had been assaulting black people in the area, and they basically told us to get lost, you know. They told us that, you know, we're a bunch of c***s, you know, niggers, black b***s, you know, language of that nature. And basically told us to leave the police station, which we did. So, to be honest with you, that was 1980, and that was the year I'd experienced the disturbances and defending myself in St. Paul's. So, to be honest with you, myself and my friend, we were quite hot. So we organised the other people there. I mean, there was about 30 or 40 guys at the time. And we put money together, and we went and bought some petrol. In those days, the milkman used to collect the bottles early in the morning. So we collected the bottles from a number of houses, put them in crates, filled the petrol. I used my my pullover as the wick, and then we organized ourselves. 30 people all of a sudden dissipated to about 8 or 9 of us. So some went round the front of the station, some went round the back. I was at the front. I was just a main man who would put the brick through the window.
or through the windows, and we did that. We lit the petrol bombs, and we sent it in front and back, and burnt the place down. No police were injured as such. I left the day after on a train back to Bristol. But eventually, you know how it is, young boys and what have you, someone's going to tell the tale. And someone did tell the tale. Then myself and my friend was arrested in Bristol and brought back to Nottingham, where we eventually stood trial, and both of us received 5 years respectively for our role in it. I mean, you know, I told the judge at the time I would do it again, and I can say it right now, I would do that again. No compulsion about that. When you try to get the law to assist you and the law turns around and spits in your face, then you must defend yourself. And if I have to do it every day of the week, I will defend myself every day of the week. So that's what happened, and that's why I had that custodial sentence.
Martin, maybe you can give us a bit of a flavour of the country at the time. I mean, you've talked about Brixton, but there was a much bigger thing going on with Thatcherism, wasn't there?
I think particularly with the police, because they'd been given a big pay rise, and they were let off the leash, and they felt that they could do what they were previously. I mean, there had been a bad atmosphere developing, and the police had a pretty politicised attitude. You know, they were fairly racist in those days, far more so than they are these days. They're much more professional today, to be honest with you. There's no comparison, and that doesn't mean they're perfect, but they really were quite shocking back in the day, and that's the consequences were the consequences. At the time, of course, the Northern Irish situation was still boiling over, and you could easily see how this could turn up into a shooting war. That's what we really feared, all of us.
Now, in 1984, meanwhile, after Balogun, or Nana as he's now known, was released from jail, Bristol was a pretty strong community.
Things were going so well in the community. I'd organised the community so well to the point where if I said, yes, let's go and demonstrate at Avon County Council, we'd get hundreds. If I said, let's demonstrate at Bristol City Council, we'd get hundreds. If I said, let's have a vigil on St. Paul's Green, we'd get hundreds. It was disturbing to the establishment. It was something that disturbed them. I mean, we did vigils to support the apartheid struggle in South Africa, for example. We did vigils when they were going to execute people in South Africa. I organised the St. Paul's Apartheid Free Zone, where we got all the shops to stop stocking and selling goods that were South African. I closed down the Barclays Bank that was on Newfoundland Road. We used to picket it every Wednesday. You'd get about 30 or 40 people, and we used to stand in the queue. And when it got to our turn, we used to say stuff like, you know, we don't want any more blood money in South Africa. Leave South Africa. Then we disrupted the business every Wednesday on Barclays Bank. We used to do sittings in there. The police used to come, used to lift us out and put us on the pavement outside, and we used to just go back in. The bank couldn't cope with it. Eventually, they closed the building, you know. They closed that institution in St. Paul's. So the establishment was so upset with what was going on that they had to find a way to destabilise the community, and they did, with the introduction of cocaine.
Martin, is this something you've heard before about the use of cocaine?
Yes, but look, you've got to remember, this is just the height of the Iran-Contra affair, where Colonel Oliver North was definitely involved with bringing massive amounts of cocaine into the US via MENA Air Base in Arkansas, which were then used to fund the Contras in Nicaragua. So that's all on the record.
What was the politics of Nicaragua at the time then?
Well, the politics of Nicaragua, you've got a revolutionary government which had won one election, then won a second election. There was a so-called rebellion against that, which was orchestrated by the United States, but the Democrat Congress in the United States had refused to allocate funds for this terrorist war in Nicaragua. So Ollie North did an end run around that by organising cocaine shipments into the United States, which had the effect, of course, of militarising black communities here and there, at the same time as providing resources for their political protégés. And it's still going on today. I tell you, Unidos Defensas de Colombia in Colombia is largely funded through, this is the right-wing paramilitaries in Colombia, largely funded through cocaine, and it's winked at by the authorities in America, because that, in the United States of America, because they are their allies.
Well, one thing I asked Balogun about, now known as Nana Kweku Angamang, over in Ghana, was what his thoughts were now about Valentine, this guy he had this court case with, who he accuses of trying to kill him.
Well, that's good for him. Good for him, good for his son. His son didn't do anything to me, so if his son has been voted as the mayor, that's fine. I mean, at the end of the day, his son is probably cleaner than him. That's the way, you know, life is. I hold no umbrage about the fact that he's the mayor at all. I've got no problem with that at all.
And what about message? Have you got any message for people in St. Paul's today about how to be well organised and what should be the priorities?
Well, all I can say to them, there is a need for the black community to come back together on a political front. They need to recognise that they're very strong as an electorate. They've got to use that power at the ballot box to get people who are like them, who are them, to represent them in Avon County Council and Bristol City Council. I think they've started it to a certain extent because you have a black mayor, you have a black deputy mayor, but we have to go beyond that. I mean, to a certain extent, you know, the mayor, you know, it's not a hardcore position as such. We need more black councillors in there, male and female, in both local authorities, so that we can get a fair share of the cake. What people don't know is that I didn't actually know my parents. I didn't actually know my real parents. And my mother died when I was 9 months, and I didn't know my father. And basically, my roots were in West Africa. And I was fortunate enough to link up with some people after I was told what had actually happened, because this was kept from me for, you know, 20-odd years. I didn't know the truth. And a lady I still know to be my mother, even though she's passed away, wasn't actually my mother. But God bless her soul, because she did her best for me. And I'm happy with what she's done, because she made me a very, very, very strong man. And so I was able to trace roots back to the Ashanti Kingdom, Nsutta Manpong. And that's where I went to stay. Having got there, I was a licensed coach. I'm a licensed football coach. I qualified at West Ham Football Club. And I'm also a level one and level two coach educator, a former referee as well. And so I came home and I thought, well, let me get involved in football. I was doing football, and because of, well, they say because I could articulate myself well in English, I also became a part of the media, and I'm considered one of the leading media personnel here in the country now. I've produced and directed my own television shows, radio shows. I've won awards for writing columns in newspapers and stuff like that. And so life just goes on. I'm in Ghana, and I'm doing what I like to do. And I'm fighting the challenges that are here too, because no matter where you go, you will find challenges, and there are a lot of challenges in Ghana.
Were you driven out of Bristol?
Yes, I was. I was driven out. I had to leave. First and foremost, I had so much hate mail as a result of linking up with Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. I mean, mail was coming through my door that was addressed to the Chief Monkey, Monkeyville, St. Paul's, Bristol. The postman was delivering those type of mails through my door. And I've had, you know, excrement come through the door, and lots of different threats. We're going to kill you, we're going to kill your wife, we're going to kill your kids, you know, lots of different things. And eventually, it was decided that I had to leave Bristol. I didn't want to leave, but I had no choice, because it was quite clear that Valentine had tried to kill me. It wasn't successful, but there were going to be other attempts on my life.
Oh, that was an allegation, by the way.
So we had a caucus, especially within the Labour Party, and we did one or two things to ensure that I would get accommodation in London, that I would be employed in London, and so I left Bristol. And, I mean, you know, that was it. I've got no regrets about the whole thing. It's been a wonderful experience. I've learnt a lot through the experience about myself, as much as I've learnt about the institutions. I have no regrets at all about anything that has gone on in my life whatsoever. It's all played a significant part in my life, and it makes me who I am today.
So that is Nana Kwaku Angamang. He used to be known as Res Kumba Balogun, one of Bristol's most notorious and probably well-respected too within the city, community leaders from the 1980s, talking about his story and also giving us some advice on priorities. And also, Esther, you're here to talk too about priorities, aren't you?
I am indeed, and I was just thinking about the parallel between the riots in 1980 and the work that we now want to do with core cities to resist austerity in local government. So yes, I'm here to talk about what we want to do to resist austerity in our city.
Okay, because the Labour Party as a whole is not entirely in agreement about how to deal with austerity, and I know that tomorrow here in Easton you're going to be launching a programme for a different set of priorities to deal with austerity. It's called Defending Bristol's Communities and Services, a Progressive Anti-Austerity Response to Local Government Cuts. So this is a document which is really aimed at both within your own party and at the city generally and other councillors across the city.
Yes, indeed it is, because the question I'd want to ask is, do we want a situation where the Labour government nationally is resisting austerity, but locally the Labour Council is implementing it?
What they will say is they've got no choice.
They may say that, but the purpose of this paper is to test every single assumption that's built into the budget and to challenge the council to ensure that every single stone is unturned in order to identify everything can be done to resist austerity.
Okay, what about your 19 points? Let's run through, maybe not all of them, but certainly you start off with something called a progressive council tax.
Ah, yes, progressive council tax. Now, this is an interesting one that Chris Williamson from Derby talked to us about at our Momentum meeting last month. And what we're talking about here is the option to run a referendum to increase council tax and to discount lower bands so that people in the biggest properties pay more council tax to help to save the city from austerity.
Martin, that sounds almost like a kind of creep back towards the rates.
Yeah, well, of course, they've still got the rates in Northern Ireland because they didn't bring in poll tax or council tax there. They didn't dare to do it because, of course, it would have been like throwing petrol on a bonfire. And, of course, you know, the council tax is a fundamentally regressive tax. So even tweaking it is not solving the problem. Ultimately, a Labour government will have to abolish it and bring back a property-based tax for local
Esther,
government.
Surely, if you're going to hold a referendum, that's going to cost even more money.
It will, but that's the law. So all of the proposals set out in this document are within the law, and we think the city should have a say in determining what happens to its services.
But you can't save money by spending money on a referendum, surely?
Ultimately, it's unfortunate that a referendum is necessary, but that's the law. And if we want to defend our services, this is an option that's available.
Oh, has that been done anywhere else?
Not yet. Well, it was tried in Kent, wasn't it? But it never got there because the government coughed up the money.
Well, actually, that's another interesting side to it. It
is, indeed.
You might not necessarily have to do the referendum, just threaten
well,
to
indeed.
Do it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Also, use of reserves and other budgets and accruals. Now, first of all, you better explain what an accrual is.
Well, an accrual is something that you put into your accounts to say it's something that you've actually spent, but you haven't actually paid out for it yet. And it's an assumption about something that might need to be paid and may not actually be.
So we've got a strategic reserve, uncommitted, apparently, of £20 million.
We do, and we have a £5.7 million risk reserve.
So what are these reserves? Now, we keep being told on this programme, in fact, I think it was Craig Cheney that said that we can't use those reserves.
Well, it's a choice.
By the way, I ought to mention, sorry to interrupt you, but yeah. I did invite 2 weeks ago Craig Cheney, who's the cabinet member for finance, I believe, onto this programme, and rather like Marvin's office, just no response. Sent him several messages, phoned him several times, and just get nothing back.
Well, I know Craig is really, really busy. I am meeting him next week because I think it would be really good to talk through these proposals with him. Now, the 20 million reserve is there for things that might happen to the city, so that the city isn't left without money if it has some sort of disaster. Again, it's a choice. A city is prudent in putting that reserve aside. And the 5.7, that's a risk reserve again for things that might turn up.
Can we say, for example, the Bristol Channel floods us up to, I don't know, the height of two or three stories in the city centre?
Yes. Yes.
That would mean that we wouldn't have that money to spend then.
Yes, but all of these proposal needs to be taken in the round because there is other money available. There are other reserves available. And so what I'm saying is that we need to comb through all of those reserves to see, taken in the round, what can be spared in order to deliver us from austerity.
So what's the difference between a committed and an uncommitted reserve?
Well,
if you've got a reserve and you've committed it, it's not really a reserve, is it?
Yeah, but it's not been set as a budget. So it's something they want to use during the year, but it's not been set as a budget yet.
Okay, and what about environmental levies?
Well, this is an early...
Paying to walk in the park?
No, this is paying to pollute the city. So it's something we think should be explored. We haven't done any work apart from identifying as something that should be explored.
This is a congestion charge. That's not going to be very popular.
Possibly,
is it?
Indeed.
I mean, I do look around and I think I wish I had shares in Siemens because you seem to have traffic lights popping up all over the place in completely unnecessary places. And in a way, I mean, we've heard various conspiracy theories about people deliberately setting traffic lights so that it causes congestion. That isn't actually beyond the realms of possibility.
And which creates pollution, yes.
But it does create the opportunity to tax people for congestion. The congestion charge you're selecting here, or suggesting?
Well, I'm suggesting it's something that should be looked at, because at the end of the day you have to make choices. So which is worse, having a congestion charge or having absolutely no services in the city?
What about council housing? Building council-owned housing, the plans should be expedited. Other capital plans should be considered, you suggest, for delay unless they provide revenue contribution.
Exactly.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Exactly that. So what we're saying is the city needs to build as many council houses as possible because then they generate income from rates.
But I'm sure Marvin would say, if he was sitting here, or Craig, we're doing all we can in building much more than George was.
Yes, they're building more, but the challenge is, can you build even more? And can you stop building things in the short term that actually might cost money rather than generate council tax?
Like what, for example?
Well, going through their capital programme to see what things they're planning to spend capital on, to see whether any of them could be slowed down.
What about parking? Parking charges?
Yeah, that's a sticky one, isn't it? Again, there is a choice to ask people to pay more for parking.
Because there was free parking, I think it's on Sundays, for example. Mm-hmm. Around where I live, in St Paul's, you get loads of people parking everywhere on a Sunday because it's free.
These are all options, aren't they?
Student accommodation.
Yeah, so I think the city does need a strategy to think about how it deals with the university and students. Now, clearly students don't have the money to pay council tax, but nevertheless, there is a lot of student accommodation going up in the city. That accommodation yields absolutely no council tax revenues. So I think the city needs to be thinking very carefully about how it does business with the university and how it works with the university so that the university pays its way.
Also, business rates.
Again, it's something that should be looked at.
In what would you suggest might happen?
Well, I could be very controversial and say that there are big businesses that make very little contribution to society, so the council might take a look at what it could do by way of business rates to ensure that they do.
What about getting big companies that are based in the city just to give money?
Well, wouldn't that be nice? Rather than making them pay more rates?
That sounds like wishful thinking. I mean, they're desperate to avoid any kind of tax.
Yeah,
they employ people specially to do that, don't they? Whole armies of these tax advisors saying, no, 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 don't pay that.
Yes, I know, but sometimes businesses respond to flattery and having their names on things, don't they? So again, it's worth looking at.
Do you also think it might be a good idea to sell off some more family silver?
It depends what it is, doesn't it? So, you know, selling off parks, absolutely not. But if there are properties that are never going to be used by the council for the people of Bristol, then yes, look at selling them off.
What about bonds and local currency? Now, this is certainly one of the most interesting things in here, potentially, because we keep hearing, don't we, that in order to be resilient, you know, we've got to watch out. Martin talks about it every week, the potential of a financial crash. With a local currency, that would ameliorate that to a certain extent.
Yeah, indeed. I'm not too sure about the local bond issue, because local government can already borrow money quite cheaply, and clearly issuing bonds may not be a way of easing revenue pressures, but it's certainly something I'd like to talk to the finance people in the council about.
A tourist tax. Now, that sort of thing is going on in certain parts of the world. It's, again, not very nice, is it, to say, come to Bristol, and by the way, you've got to pay to walk into the city?
Well, Bath does it, doesn't it? So if Bath can do it, why not Bristol? And Bristol is a wonderful place. I don't think it would stop people from coming here. It'd probably go on to the price of their hotel beds, wouldn't it?
What about, I mean, this is a much bigger one, isn't it? The political strategy, developing a progressive political strategy in isolation won't be enough, you say, to gain support for Labour locally and build pressure on the Tory government to restore government funding. Policy development needs to go hand in hand with the political strategy working across a number of fronts. Now, you go through things like national parliamentary campaigning, across core cities, coordination with community activist groups and NGOs and public campaigns. Now, this is a bit of an all-encompassing one, isn't it? Do you think it's really possible for the mayor's office to be talking to all these people, NGOs, other core cities, national campaigns, public campaigns? I mean, we can't even get him to come on this programme.
No, well, the mayor has been working with core cities. They wrote a green paper, didn't they? And they went up to Parliament with their green paper to talk to ministers. So they're already busy.
The ministers didn't want to talk to them.
No, they don't. So we need to escalate the campaign through our own MPs. We need to make sure that questions are being asked in Parliament. We need to make sure that the implications of the massive cuts to the revenue support grant are understood.
What about coordination across the core cities? What are the core cities, and can they really work as one united front?
Well, because a number of the core cities are seeing the same pressures as Bristol, we want to work in solidarity with them. So we've invited some of them to our day tomorrow to look at rolling out the actions to support this plan. And we think that the core cities have a lot in common, and that it's a solidarity issue that if we work together, we'll have a stronger voice in Parliament and elsewhere.
Well, I mean, it sounds like tomorrow might be a bit of a love-in with everyone sort of talking to each other, but are you actually going to get anywhere? Because even the mayor and senior people at the city council and other core cities have been to Westminster to try and get change and failed.
Well, to be fair, the Green Paper didn't actually mention cuts or austerity at all. It was about a growth-driven agenda, prosperity-driven agenda. I think they've had a go, but we need to try harder. And certainly we want to work tomorrow to develop the ideas in this plan into something tangible that we'll work with. And we've got a lot of people that worked very hard on the election that could work very hard on this. And we're sure that's the case in the other core cities too.
Can you tell us whereabouts? So just remind me whereabouts. It's 1 o'clock tomorrow here in Easton. Where exactly?
It's at Bagotal.
Which is?
Oh, where's that? All Hallows, yeah.
All Hallows Hall.
Yeah. Near All Hallows Hall, yeah. Also, I mean, I do wonder whether there's any real, I mean, it's surely this is policy and decisions that have got to be made by the mayor and by the cabinet. Effectively, just bringing public campaigns in is not going to help.
Yeah, but we live in a democracy, don't we? And people have an opportunity to challenge the council. And of course, we can work with our councillors who in turn can challenge the council. There is voting that needs to take place on whether cuts go ahead or not. And we'd hope that council and the councillors would be prepared to listen to people. And certainly in my discussions with Craig next week, I'd hope that we'd be able to work through all of the issues and numbers in this document.
Well, I'd like to be a fly on the wall in that discussion, because I mean, we've had Craig on here, we've had others on here from the cabinet talking about all this, and I'm not sure. I mean, what they say to me, Esther, is that they're doing everything they can. They need to have a balanced budget, but they're doing everything they can.
They They are probably doing everything they can. I think one of the problems is that what we have is compassionate administrators when actually we need radical politicians, and they're doing their job very, very well and need support if they're going to be breaking the mould or challenging austerity and the status quo in any way. And I can understand why it's very, very difficult.
So effectively what you're suggesting there is that they're getting these plans put in front of them and they're just signing on the dotted line without actually necessarily challenging on an intellectual or a financial and an accountant level, really, what they're being given.
Yeah, so we know that Denise Murray put the budget up and it was recommended to Cabinet by the Mayor and by the finance leader on the Cabinet, Craig, so we know that, and we know that Council accepted it. I did have a question to ask, a statement to make at Council this week about the extent to which all councillors had training in understanding the very, very complicated accounts and budgets that the Council puts together.
Well, Esther, I don't know how you do it, actually. When I look at these balance sheets and I look at these great long reports...
Well, I trained for 3 years as a public finance accountant, so I've got an advantage over many other people. I just wonder how much training and help other people have.
So effectively, they're signing on the dotted line. Is there any way, do you think, that you can kind of convince them that they should be adding in a process where they're bringing more people into being presented with a potential budget and then actually signing one off that they're prepared to support?
Yeah, I think there's definitely room for a much more robust and open challenge around the budget that's set, as a number of the issues that we've identified illustrates, really.
Sounds to me like you're saying they don't know what they're doing.
No, I'm not saying that at all. And obviously, they're very, very busy. The budget's really, really complicated, as are the accounts. They do know a lot, but having other heads to look at the problem with them can't be a bad thing.
Martin, what do you make of this? I think one of the comments that you've made in the past is that Marvin, as the mayor, seems to be moving towards an administration that is just an enabler. It doesn't actually provide services. And we could be in the situation by 2020 where all the city council is doing is really providing for social care, nothing else.
I'm afraid that is the situation. I think the situation is very dire for the mayor, and it's very difficult to see what to do. I mean, I listen with interest to what's being proposed by Esther there. I don't know if I've got the competence to say whether these things are viable or not. Fundamentally, of course, it's all wrong. We need a completely different setup with a completely different finance of local government, probably based on a property tax.
I mean,
also a change of macroeconomic policy so that we're not impoverishing ourselves for the hell of it.
We know by having mayors, there's far less democracy around. Do you think that the financial settlement by 2020 is also an attack, an assault on...
Well, I think...
Martin, let me finish the sentence. An assault on local democracy, so that by 2020 there may be virtually none left at
all? Well, I think the whole thing is very paradoxical, because it's the Tories who've pushed this idea of elected mayors and imposed it in many places, and it's supposed to create the idea that, you know, there's more people, more involvement, local democracy is being watered and developed. But in actual fact, they've removed all power from the mayor. So we have a whole show of electing a mayor and deciding to have one and then electing one. But the actual fact, they've got far less power. When Ken Livingstone was running the Greater London Council in the 1980s, as we were talking about earlier, he wasn't a mayor, he was the head of the Labour group. And he had business rates, which allowed him to put a fractional business rate on the City of London, which gave him a huge slush fund to spend in the poorer areas of the city. And of course, they had to eventually abolish the Greater London Council, because there was no way he was going to lose a democratic election, because the system was set up in such a way that the prosperous businesses in the centre of London could be milked to fund the poor people in the boroughs.
We could be heading down the way of Catalonia and Ukraine, because in both of those countries, one of the major complaints was that we're getting actually no control over the way our taxes are spent. All the taxes are going to central government and we're getting nothing back.
Can I just point this out, though, that what happens, the way capitalism works, is it isn't just about government expenditure. So, for example, in Ireland for many years, or Scotland, taxpayers there were paying to educate people to high level, to tertiary level, and then those people, 80% of the graduates in Britain end up in the southeast of England. That means people in South Wales are paying to educate people who never spend their money in South Wales, never live in South Wales, and the whole system is rigged to suck resources into the southeast of England, which then, of course, causes property bubbles, which then have to be dealt with by raising interest rates. So that all industry north of the Wash is then smashed. And of course the people in the southeast think that they're subsidising the north. It's not true. The real capitalism works to suck resources out of peripheral regions and into core regions. Yeah. And then when it's redistributed, as it used to be in Britain from the 1940s to the 1970s, you've got a successful United Kingdom. But we've given up on all of that, and that's why we've got the divisions we've got.
Yeah, it may be that if we don't act, that we may no longer be a United Kingdom.
No, we won't. Because the Irish are going to probably, you know, the whole question of the Irish border and all the rest of it is coming back on the agenda. It's a very important... You see, the Tory right think that it's the Germans who are blocking a deal on Brexit. It's not. It's Dublin. It's the Irish question coming back again.
Mm. Anyway, Esther, what do you make of Martin's analysis there?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very tricky times. And I think, as I think dissent may build, as austerity gets even harsher, it's not going to get any better unless something dramatic changes. And as Martin said, a new Labour government would change the way we raise money for local government. And these measures, the measures set out in this paper, are temporary ones. They can only last a couple of years, and then we need to move to a different approach.
I mean, is it inevitable that we'll have virtually no local government left by 2020, do you think?
Yeah, so what councillors are saying is we'll just about be able to manage to pay for social care and statutory functions, not much else.
I don't seem to remember the Conservatives winning either of the last two general elections on that ticket of abolishing local government.
No.
Well, no. And I think that, as you've seen, when they tried to introduce academisation across the board, even in the Tory shires, Tory councillors who are quite happy about the way they run their local schools opposed it. And, I think the pendulum will swing against this. And what we need is a general election as soon as possible. Possibly before Christmas, get the current shambolic situation sorted out, and then we should move rapidly to change a lot of things that have needed changing for 30 years.
Well, let's have a listen to the Mayor now, because at his State of the City speech about 6 or 8 weeks ago, he had a lot to say about the budget and about how he was going to handle money in the city.
Now, we in Bristol are not alone in a budget challenge. Every council has what's being called a graph of doom that shows the funding gap created by reduced funding versus the rising cost of adult social care and children's services. Councils have reached breaking point with everyone expecting someone somewhere to fail, but hoping it won't be them. After a decade of austerity, the UK is heading rapidly towards the bottom of the league table on public spending. And we are left balancing the need to protect life and limb crisis services against the need to invest in early interventions such as children's centres and mental health, which pay off over the medium term. And in turn, against the non-service areas such as the city's cultural offer. Now, I'm sometimes asked to set a no-cuts budget, effectively a budget that doesn't balance, or to use reserves or to borrow. And I feel the temptation. Because austerity is a mistaken philosophy, both for moral and strategic reasons. It's hurting people and undermining our economy. But the no-cuts budget argument is flawed. First, we would, of course, cede political control of our city to unelected officials from Westminster. Second, on the use of reserves and borrowing, this is an ephemeral solution, and each year will effectively worsen the situation, although we do use some reserves. Third, the argument for an unbalanced budget misses a vital fact, that the council is integral to the health of the wider economy, and a failure to manage our finances would damage the whole city's reputation and undermine the confidence of government, private sector and international investors. The developers we need to build our homes would withdraw. The major infrastructure schemes we are planning would struggle to secure the finance needed, and the ability to grow our economy would be undermined. The price the people of Bristol would pay through lost growth and lost jobs would be greater than the total value of the services the advocates of an illegal budget are fighting to protect. So I say again clearly tonight, I will set a balanced budget during my administration. I will continue to point out the damage being caused by austerity and campaign for a better deal for government. But the city cannot afford for us to carry forward the attitude of previous administrations of kicking difficult decisions down the road.
nobody is advocating an illegal budget. The proposals in this paper are about a balanced budget, but by using different approaches to achieve that balance.
He's saying that potentially developers could be driven out of the city, and people who are actually creating growth and jobs might be driven out of the city if we don't carry on doing what we're doing and what he's suggesting.
I don't follow that by setting a budget that stops services being cut will drive services and businesses out of the city. I just don't follow that argument.
Let's go to Westminster anyway, finally, and have a listen to Prime Minister's questions, where some of the stuff that we've been talking about actually on the ground is happening. And I'm thinking particularly about the fallout from Grenfell Tower and also the looming horrors of Universal Credit.
Jeremy Corbyn!
Mr Speaker, the coroner after Lacknell House thought that fitting sprinklers would be a right thing to do. The chief fire officer thinks it's a right thing to do. Those local authorities that have asked central government... Those local authorities that have asked central government for support to retrofit sprinklers have all been refused by her government. Surely we need to think about the safety of the people living in socially rented high-rise blocks. Yesterday, I was passed a letter, Mr. Speaker, from a lettings agency in Lincolnshire, where Universal Credit is about to be rolled out. The agency, and I have the letter here, the agency is issuing all of its tenants with a preemptive notice of eviction because Universal Credit has driven up arrears where it's been rolled out. And the letter, and I quote, says... The letter says, and I quote, GAP Property cannot sustain arrears at the potential levels Universal Credit could create. Will the Prime Minister pause Universal Credit so it can be fixed? Or does she think it is right to put thousands of families through Christmas in the trauma of knowing they're about to be evicted because they're in rent arrears because of Universal Credit?
Prime Minister!
Can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that there have been concerns raised, there have been concerns raised in this House previously over the issue of people managing their budgets to pay rent. But what we actually see, what we see that after 4 months, the number of people on Universal Credit in arrears has fallen by a third. Now, it's important that we do look at the issues on this particular case. Now, the Right Honourable Gentleman might like to send the letter through. I know in an earlier Prime Minister's questions, he raised a specific constituency, a specific case of an individual who'd written to him about her experience on Universal Credit. I think it was Georgina. As far as I'm aware, he has so far not sent that letter to me, despite the fact that I asked.
Anyway, Universal Credit, I mean, this whole business of sprinklers, we'll leave that aside for a minute. But Esther, Universal Credit, what do you make of that? It looks like it could be a train crash waiting to happen.
Well, clearly, people afraid of losing their homes. Everyone is preparing for the worst. There has to be some sort of U-turn.
Martin?
Well, I mean, this all Ian Duncan Smith's big idea that he was going to give people money directly instead of paying it directly to the landlords, and the private landlords, buy-to-let landlords, do not want to rent to people on Universal Credit. It's a fundamental problem, but they won't recognise it as fundamental. It's just administrative nonsense.
As I understand it, Bristol and Bath are getting organised against it, and we'll be hearing more about that next week. It's time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, National Health Service Finance Manager and Labour Party member Esther Giles. Her event is on at just near All Hallows Hall in Easton tomorrow at 1. Join us after the news.
3.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.